Chapter 7. How do you say it? More fuels of the camp system. Asking good questions is the highest octane fuel we have. They are a key behavioral goal. Of the five other behavioral goals that I call the fuels of the system, four work in direct support of our questions. They help us control what we say. They help us use our words to our advantage. I call these four fuels nurturing, reversing, connecting, and 3+. The fifth fuel, unrelated to questions, is the strip line. Now, there are some quirky names in that list, but that's okay. Much of the behavior they require is contrarian to conventional win-win wisdom. It is this contrarian and unexpected behavior that allows us to transcend the average and gives us a great advantage. Nurturing. We all know what the word means. Nurturing means to feed emotionally, to provide moral training, to foster the mind with good and understanding and appreciative thoughts. Who brings good nurturing thoughts and memories to your mind? Maybe it was your grandmother who always had a kind word, or your mom or dad when she or he tucked you in at night, or others who put you at ease by the way in which they talked to you. Maybe it was a warm, soft conversation, or a conversation that was heavy with respect. What you had to say was important to this individual, and she or he wanted to listen. Just to be listened to can bring good thoughts to mind. In a negotiation, nurturing will keep the negotiation going through thick and thin. Your ability to nurture will be the key to bringing the negotiation back to the table after a breakdown. Your ability to nurture your adversary, to put him or her at ease, is the key to assuring her that you're listening and that you value what she has to say. Nurturing is also just another way to allow your adversary to feel okay. Nurturing should be part of your body language. When you're seated, refrain from a sudden forward movement. Lean back. Relax your neck, face, and hands. If you're standing, lean against the wall. Lower your posture. No one's going to deal effectively with you if you're towering over them. This is common sense, and even an average negotiator would pretty much adhere to this principle. But a lot of average negotiators give out the wrong signals in less obvious ways. They lean forward and jerk their arms and smack the table. The truly comfortable, trained negotiator takes it easy. When in doubt, slow your cadence of speech. Lower your voice. As the old saying goes, laughter often is the best medicine, especially laughter directed at ourselves. Laughter is a way to nurture everyone in the room, including ourselves. Now, none of this is contrarian at all. Granted, you won't find a section about nurturing in most negotiation books, but that's just because those authors are trying to impress you with their arcane academic theories and charts and graphs. They wouldn't disagree with me on this point. They just incorrectly believe it's not hotshot material. The way you phrase questions and statements can be either nurturing or almost the opposite. Let's revisit some of the questions from the discussion so far and find the nurturing in them. Hey, how's it going? This is nurturing. That's a good question. This is nurturing. Boy, you look grim. Not quite so nurturing, unless you're teasing a good friend. That question does nothing for me. Not quite so nurturing. Even more important than what you say for nurturing purposes is how you say it. Think of the sentence, "Is this what you really want?" These six words can cut either way. If I say them abruptly and abrasively, they're the opposite of nurturing. But if I ask the question quietly and with concern, even though it's a verb-led question, it's very nurturing. I see nothing wrong with taking a minute right now to put this book down and ask that question aloud in a number of ways, including, "Is this what you really want?" And softly, "Is this what you really want?" You'll immediately see the differences on the nurturing scale. Delivery is everything. We all know this, but too often we forget it. Now, please don't misunderstand me. I'm not into touchy-feely negotiations. Nurturing must not be confused with being easy and soft. Nurturing does not signal arbitrary compromise. It does not mean saving the adversary from a tough decision. Nurturing is simply a psychological move that allows just a little stress to be released at the right moment. One of the toughest men of the 20th century was Sir Winston Churchill. But if you study his writings and listen to recordings of his speeches, you'll discover both his bulldog toughness and his nurturing moves. If you listen to the speeches on tape, you'll hear his naturally nurturing voice. Likewise, Joe Lieberman, vice presidential candidate for the Democratic Party in 2000, became known for his naturally nurturing voice and demeanor. He could say almost anything and get away with it. Think of a psychologist trying to pry out your deepest, darkest secrets. Is she going to do so with a harsh, challenging voice, or with a calm, gentle voice? Nurturing requires the delicate touch. Nurturing may be just the one right word, or facial expression, or gesture. How you nurture will require great practice, insight, and reflection. When the going gets tough in a negotiation, your biggest challenge will be your ability to nurture your adversary in spite of everything else going on. I should put that in bold-faced capital letters, but I won't, because, well, that wouldn't be very nurturing, would it? Reversing. This is a behavior that you must hone to perfection for successful negotiations. The reverse is the behavioral tactic that answers a question with a question, the answer to which will do you some good. When your adversary asks you a question, you do have to say something, but not in the way in which you were trained in school. How are you? Great. How are you? That's a reverse, isn't it? And effective. But more often than not, for a variety of reasons, untrained negotiators aren't alert for the opportunity to answer questions by asking questions. Maybe they're too busy talking up themselves and divulging information. Many times they assume that they already know the answer, or they don't understand the difference between verb-led and interrogative-led questions, and they're tired of hearing no in response to incorrect verb-led questions. Meanwhile, the trained negotiator looks for every opportunity to answer a question with a question. Vital point. The reverse should be preceded by a short nurturing statement, because you don't want to sound like a district attorney during cross-examination. Without the nurturing tidbit, the reverse will do you little good. But if you have any doubt that the nurturing reverse works, try it the next time you're talking with someone at the proverbial water cooler. We human beings are seduced by it every time. Jim, what'll this option do for me? That's a good question, Dick. Before we get into that, what's the biggest challenge you're facing in this area? Nurture, reverse. Well, that was certainly well thought out. By the way, what are your cost constraints? We definitely have to talk about that, but before we go there... Interesting. Really interesting. How soon will you be up against a deadline here? That's something I hadn't thought of. When could you deliver? What am I missing here? What else can you tell me about that? My son Brian now plays college football for a major program. He was not the high school recruit I mentioned in Chapter 3, but when Brian was being recruited a couple of years ago, he was asked by the dean of students with arguably the most prestigious and respected football program in the country, what do you think would be the most challenging part of playing football for this school? Brian's answer was rather long, but it was a great reverse. Gee, that's a great question. I'd like to toss it back at you because I've got so many things going through my mind. I'd like your help in understanding how you really see it, because you've got so much experience in this. What are the things I should really be aware of? Most potential recruits who came through this dean's office were making a required stop and could not have cared less about anything the man had to say. But this camp-trained recruit, my son, had let the dean know that he wasn't a cocky, self-aggrandizing kid who thought he had all the answers. There are a lot of these kids around, you know, and quite a few such adults as well. The recruit also allowed the dean to be the most okay person in the room, always a plus. The dean was delighted to have a kid who actually seemed to respect his opinion, and he was a great source of insight into the way the campus worked and the unusual pressures on football players, since it's such a high-profile program. When we drove through the gates at the end of the visit, Brian said, "I don't want to go to school in a museum." On another campus, Brian was interviewing with the highly respected football coach. I apologize for using two such examples in a row, but both speak to the subject of reversing, and the fact that each was carried out by an 18-year-old high school student demonstrates that the behavioral goal of reversing is readily available to all of us. The coach was talking to Brian about his size, which is large, and then he asked Brian how flexible he was. Brian quickly reversed and said, Well, in my high school, we work pretty hard with weights, Coach. How much emphasis do you put on weightlifting in your program? The coach told my son that he didn't really believe in a lot of weight training for quarterbacks, Brian's position at the time. The coach was concerned that the size and strength of today's quarterbacks was limiting their flexibility. My son hadn't studied the physiology of exercise, but he knew that the coach's concern was grounded in exercise theories of 20 years ago and almost falls into the category of myth today. In the last 3 or 4 years, hasn't Tiger Woods totally destroyed old-time myths about how strength exercises are bad for the flexibility sports? And look at the baseball players, even the pitchers. So there's no room in modern athletics for that coach's outmoded and incorrect thinking. And my son's simple reverse gave him all the information he needed about that program. The coach's answer was one of the reasons Brian didn't go to that particular school. In any negotiation, the reverse assures that you're dealing with an important question for you, thereby allowing you to gather more insight and information. Your job is to get information from the adversary by asking questions, not provide information by answering questions. Reversing is nothing more than the lawyer's standard technique of clarification. Questions and reversing help us get into the world of the adversary. They are the way we create vision. Without reversing and asking questions, we'll get nowhere. Sometimes you feel you absolutely have to give some kind of answer. In this case, give a no-risk answer. If your adversary asks your opinion about a given matter, what she's really after is your agreement. Don't give it to her. Well, Mary, I know how you feel, and I really respect your opinion, but to tell you the truth, I haven't had time to solidify my opinion. You may be right, I'm sort of going both ways, but your opinion is always in the back of my mind. You haven't given up any information, and you have ever so subtly made your adversary think you're supporting her position without actually doing so. How much does it cost? A lot. How long have you guys been working on this? Seems like forever. You're satisfying the necessity of answering, but the information you're giving is, for all intents and purposes, not worth much. Most of the time, however, your adversary will not recognize this, will accept the answer, and will be open to a good question from you. Connecting. As I've said in several contexts, we have a tendency to want to save our adversary, to be liked. This instinct can impel us into these three common negotiating errors, which I've derived from what every attorney tells his client before a deposition or testimony. Never answer an unasked question. Don't interpret a statement as a question. And never reply to random statements. I don't like what I see, Jim. When we hear this, many of us will feel an urge to reply in some way, to try to set things straight. Well, Damon, this isn't written in concrete. No. The best way to deal with the leading unasked question or the provocative remark is to use it as a basis for prying out more information. How? By employing what I call a connector. To respond is average negotiating behavior. To connect is contrarian negotiating behavior and much more effective. Think about the psychiatrist whose job it is to help the client understand his problems and then deal with them. Here's one possible exchange. Doctor, you're not helping me.
I think I am helping you.
No, you're not helping me at all.
Of course I'm helping you.
If you're helping me so much, then why do I feel so bad?
Well, you feel bad because you're not committed.
I am committed. You're just not a very good shrink.
The patient is correct. This is not a good shrink.
Now, let's see how the nurturing connector might have improved the exchange. Doctor, you're not helping me at all.
Help me understand.
Well, I just don't feel as though I'm making any progress.
And?
Well, I'm having trouble doing the exercises you told me to do.
I see.
What's the most difficult problem you're having with the exercises? That little word, and, when asked as a question, is an excellent connector.
I don't like what I see, Jim.
And?
This is drawn out, accompanied by a shrug. The adversary now has to fill in the picture for Jim. I don't like what I see, Jim.
And?
This is drawn out, accompanied by a shrug. The adversary now has to fill in the picture for Jim.
I can't get too excited about this until I see your competition.
Fine. You've learned something. In effect, the connection is another type of reverse. Your adversary's floating remark, gauged to get some kind of reaction from you, is turned around with the intent of getting some kind of useful information from him.
Wow, this is pretty much out of nowhere.
Which means, accompanied by a shrug,
well, this isn't going to happen unless you lose a zero.
Fine again. You've learned something. Profound silent concern on your part can also serve as a connector. People don't like silence. It's the void that our nature abhors. Your adversary will rush to fill in the blank.
Wow, this is pretty much out of nowhere.
Silence.
This isn't going to happen unless you can deliver next month.
Now you're really getting somewhere. The connector, like the reverse, has helped get us to the real issue.
I don't like your attitude.
Well, how can I help you?
Your price is too high.
Oh, this is real progress. Your attitude was never the problem. Again, these little dialogues are on the stagey side, I admit, but they're not all that stagey. In somewhat extended form, they happen every day. The trained negotiator practices every day. 3+. The fuel 3+ is simple and important. What is it? Nothing more than the ability to remain with a question until it is answered at least 3 times, or to repeat a statement at least 3 times. This is not an original idea. Anyone who's ever taken a speech class knows the old rule. Tell them what you're going to tell them. Tell them. Tell them what you told them. 1, 2, 3 times. I first heard the equivalent rule many, many years ago from a salesman friend and quickly learned that this was good advice. I've added the plus because I've found that 3 times often isn't enough, so I coach 3+ times. The more critical the negotiation, the more times over a longer period of time you may need to reiterate the agreed-upon point. In practice, it's difficult to overdo the 3+, almost impossible. In the conference call that started the Network Inc. renegotiation regarding the contract that was losing $100,000 per machine shipped, the president of Network actually informed his adversaries that he would repeat what he had to say about the problem 3 times, because it was so serious he wanted to make sure it was clear and understood by each and every one of them. I don't usually coach that you literally announce that you'll use 3+, but it was appropriate to do so in this negotiation. Of course, you must nurture or reverse with 3+. You have to make certain that the agreement you're hearing from the adversary on this particular is truly agreement. As always, you're extremely suspicious of yes. Most of all, you cannot sound needy to nail down this point of agreement. The 3+ technique cannot seem to the adversary like pressure in any way. It cannot be pressure in any way. When you use 3+, you always have to leave the option for the adversary to change his mind. You are not rushing to close 3 times. Just the opposite, of course. You're asking for no 3 times. That's the way to think about it. How many times have you tried to make a decision and had thoughts like this run through your mind? I'm going to do it. No, I'm not. Yeah, I think I am. I hate it. I'm not going to do it. Whether we use 3+ or 20+, we always give the adversaries the opportunity to go through this process in their own minds. The 3+ technique goes hand in hand with never close. The whole point of 3+ is to give the adversary multiple opportunities to look at their decision, to verify it, to justify it, or to change it. We give the adversary every chance to think through the situation. Look at it from different perspectives, and see for themselves how their thinking changes. The adversary doesn't always see what they should see, and using the 3+ technique helps them get a good picture. No vision, no decision. The strip line. I introduced the strip line, the last of the fuels of the system, with the analogy of the pendulum swinging back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. That's what a negotiation can be like. Initially, the pendulum is stationary. Emotions are calm, neither positive nor negative. Then something happens. Someone says something, and this force pushes the pendulum into the negative, say. Then some factor halts the movement into the negative and pulls the pendulum all the way past neutral and toward the positive. All these back-and-forth emotional swings can be catastrophic to the negotiation, especially if they're big and dramatic. The task of the good negotiator is to keep the pendulum as close as possible to a calm, stationary mode. The big negative swings don't do any more good in the long run, and neither do the big positive swings. Let's take a straight sales situation, although the picture works just as well for any negotiation of any kind. If you, the salesperson, allow the potential customer to swing too hard into the positive mode, what happens when the inevitable second thoughts and doubts set in? The pendulum that was high in the positive mode swings down with so much momentum it carries all the way through neutral and into the hard negative mode. Now what do you do? This may be a position from which you never recover. Of course, the eternal optimist says, well, the next change of emotion will carry it from deep in the negative back to high in the positive. Okay, fine. But then what? You see, these big swings are a vicious cycle, so to speak, and they're almost impossible to control. But you must maintain control. So what's the solution? It's simple, in theory. Avoid both the strongly negative and the strongly positive by staying in the calm, neutral range, which is where we find the deals that stick. This is totally contrarian negotiating. You mean we don't want the adversary to get all excited about this deal? No, we don't, because the excitement won't last. Those inevitable second thoughts will come along sooner or later. So how do we stay in the neutral range and keep all the emotions under control during a negotiation? We use the strip line, a reference to a technique in bone fishing and other types of fishing as well, in which you feed line to the fish when it first takes the bait rather than set the hook. This is the only way to catch bonefish, which take off at incredible speeds the moment they're hooked. With bonefish, setting the hook immediately just rips it right out. By stripping line, you avoid putting on too much pressure. Likewise, in a negotiation, by stripping line, you take the pressure off the adversary. It's an extremely effective tool, and it's a lot of fun for me to see the initial doubt about strip line on the part of my clients turn into enthusiastic endorsement as they see how effective it is. Sometimes they get so excited I have to use strip line to draw them back a little. It's not a panacea, just a darn good tool. Now that I've introduced this idea of releasing pressure, you can see that 3+ is also a way to release pressure. So is giving the adversary the right to say no. So is allowing the adversary to be okay. So is no closing. When used effectively, the strip line, like all those other behavioral goals, will allow your adversary the opportunity to validate information and decisions that have gone before. The negative strip line. The strip line comes in different types to be used in different situations. The first type I'll examine is the negative strip line, which I'll illustrate first with the movie Legal Eagles, in which that great actor Robert Redford plays an experienced assistant district attorney who's just been fired for complicated reasons. For other complicated reasons, Redford joins Deborah Winger, a small-time defense attorney, in her advocacy on behalf of the Daryl Hannah character, a beautiful young woman accused of killing her lover. This is a dream case for the scandal sheets and way over Winger's inexperienced head. The prosecution has a murder weapon, a motive, and an eyewitness who puts the defendant at the scene. It's apparent from the reaction to the prosecution's opening statement that the jury and the press have already found Redford's new client guilty. This is an open-and-shut case. Picture a packed courtroom and a circus-like atmosphere as the district attorney finishes his powerful introduction. How should Redford proceed? How could he possibly shift the pendulum even a little way from the powerfully negative toward the neutral? He begins his opening remarks in a normal fashion. Ladies and gentlemen, Chelsea Dearden did not kill Victor Taft. The prosecution has suggested a possible motive, but one based entirely on hearsay, conjecture, and circumstantial evidence. Evidence that on the surface would appear to have some substance, but upon closer examination will prove to have no relevance whatsoever to this case. Okay, a decent start, but the camera tells us that Redford's remarks are falling on deaf ears in the jury box. He knows this as well, of course, and here comes the hard negative strip line. Redford stops suddenly, looks into the jury's eyes, tilts his head in that winning way of his, and says, "You're not buying this, are you? You're not listening to a word I'm saying. Really? Right?" Pregnant pause. "Guess what? I don't blame you. After listening to the prosecution's evidence, even I'm convinced my client murdered Victor Taft. After all, if I'd walked into the room and found Victor Taft dead on the floor and Chelsea Dearden's fingerprints all over the weapons that killed him, there isn't much in the world that wouldn't convince me she was guilty. Look, let's just save ourselves a lot of time here. Who thinks Chelsea Dearden is guilty?" When Redford asks for a show of hands on this question, the prosecution objects. The judge grumbles. Redford continues. "Come on, I've got my hand raised. I believe that my client murdered Victor Taft in cold blood. Who agrees with me? Come on." More objections. More grumbles. "Let's save the state of New York a lot of time and money and move directly to sentencing." Redford has gone so negative even his co-counsel, who didn't know what was coming, is having her doubts. The defendant is beside herself. With the courtroom now in chaos, the judge calling for order, reporters racing for the phones, Redford finds himself near the jury box, where one respectable-looking middle-aged woman, played by the actress Liz Sheridan, who later in her career played Jerry Seinfeld's mother on his TV series, by the way, asks softly, "Isn't she entitled to a fair trial?" Redford replies instantly, "Oh, let's give her a fair trial and then convict her." By now, the judge has had enough, disqualifies the jury, and threatens Redford with contempt. Redford begs the judge's indulgence. He says he's perfectly happy with this jury and has faith in them, even though they believe his client is guilty. The prosecutor expresses his satisfaction with the jury, and the judge relents. Brilliant negotiating by Redford. With the emotional pendulum set solidly in the negative area in the beginning, he used his hard, negative strip line, "You're not buying this, are you?" to insinuate himself right into the heart of that negative emotion. What was he trying to accomplish? Stabilization, that's all. He wanted to wake up the jury to their bias and plant a second thought. By joining their decision of no, he had enticed them into shifting into the intellectual mode, if only for a moment. Remember that the value of the word no is that it is, unlike maybe, a real decision. And as a decision, it has to be intellectually validated by the adversary, by the jury in this particular negotiation. Redford has their full attention now. They were still negative, but at least they were thinking. Then he said, "You're not listening to a word I'm saying." That was another hard strip line that nudged the emotional pendulum just a little more toward neutral. Then came, "Guess what? I don't blame you." Another hard strip line. How many negative strip lines are required in a given negotiation is always a judgment call, but a good rule of thumb is to continue until you see or feel evidence of significant movement by that pendulum. When Redford finally feels it with this jury, he subtly introduces the presumption of innocence. "So we all think she's guilty. Now what do we do? It's a dilemma, isn't it?" It's an especially difficult problem because we've developed a legal concept in this country to protect ourselves, to protect our rights. It's called the presumption of innocence. And you know that Daryl Hannah is soon found innocent, or rather the case against her is dismissed when the actual murderer is discovered. Legal Eagles is definitely not a great movie, but that was a great negative strip line by Robert Redford. Hats off. Now, a real-life story. I recently switched cell phone companies because the spotty coverage I was experiencing was intolerable. I travel a lot and require as close to nationwide coverage as I can get. But the last straw with this company was the day I couldn't get through to San Francisco as I was driving up from San Jose. And it wasn't my phone unit because I had invested in a high-end phone. When I got home, I called the company to stop my service and gave the guy the reason I was switching to a competitor. What do you think he said? Here are his exact words. "What do you mean? I was just in San Francisco and didn't have any problems. We have great coverage." I don't know about your reaction to this statement, but in my book, this guy was calling me a liar. Think of the other mistakes he made as well. He took away my right to say no. He didn't allow me to feel okay. He didn't ask good questions to get a little more information. And he didn't strip line. He did use an interrogative-led question, which just proves that you still have to use your head and your common sense when following the rule to ask interrogative-led questions. His wasn't a nurturing question, to say the least. I was so strongly negative on this outfit, this guy could have offered me the world and I would have said no thank you. But what if he'd used a strip line and said, I'd probably switch companies too if that happened to me. But before you do that, why don't you let me give you a free upgrade and check out our coverage for 10 days? His negative strip line would have neutralized my harshly negative emotional state. Who knows, he might have hooked me up for at least another 10 days, and he might have saved the situation. There is no better tool around than the hard negative strip line to neutralize a negative pendulum swing and get the situation into the neutral range. Try it sometime. Find a good opportunity to say, "Well, this is bad. I don't know if we can recover from this." Quite likely, your adversary will then help you recover. And it's so much fun when this happens. The positive strip line. Now, the positive strip line is just that, a way to bring the adversary back toward a more neutral position from a position that's too positive. Yes, too positive. The well-trained car salesman puts a slight damper on his customer's excitement over the black car by saying, "Black is a powerful color for a sports car, but it sure shows the dirt. It'll take work." This brings the positive adversary closer to neutral, and at the same time urges him to validate his own enthusiasm for the color black, his vision of the color black. He replies, "Yeah, but if I buy this car, keeping it clean will be a pleasure." Workshop students have said to me at this stage of my spiel, "You must be kidding." Hardly. In all honesty, I could not name one instance in which a positive strip line ever backfired. It just never backfires. To believe that it might is to misunderstand human nature and your purpose as a negotiator. The lightest possible strip line is used to bring the adversary back toward neutral almost as icing on the cake. It controls any neediness of your own, reinforces the adversary's right to say no, lets the adversary be okay, and gets you deals that stick. Believing that the positive strip is dangerous reveals that you're stuck in a rush-to-close mode. Remember, everything hinges on your adversary's vision. You want to do everything you can to build that vision. The positive strip line does just that, as you'll learn the minute you put this fuel into practice. Before you sign this deal, are you sure this is something you really want to do? "Yes, I've thought about it a great deal, and it makes perfect sense." Or, "That's great, Joan. I appreciate your interest, but we still have a lot of challenges to work on." Nirvana. Right now, you may be thinking, "Wait a minute, Camp. In this chapter and the preceding one on the fuels of the camp system, you've been introducing ways to obtain as much information from the adversary as possible while divulging as little information as possible. What happens when you run into an adversary who also knows the gym camp system?" I wish it were so. Such a negotiation would proceed at a splendid pace. Both sides would be working from valid mission and purpose statements and with valid goals. Both parties would put their cards on the table at an early stage in the negotiation. Both sides would be quick to say no and then to explain why. We wouldn't have to engage in reversing and connecting in order to pry out information and answers. We wouldn't need strip line in order to keep everyone's emotions on an even keel. The fuels of the system are means to elicit information and to keep the negotiation moving smoothly. With two camp-trained negotiators as adversaries, this smooth exchange is almost a given.